Last class, we finished off chapter 3, and we didn't make it to review, so I wanted to go ahead and go into review unless anyone had questions from chapter 3 from last class. So, quick review. Who did we say the author of the book of Ecclesiastes was?
Solomon.
And the theme of the whole book?
What prophet is there in the sun?
What's the main thing we hear repeated over and over and over? The outcome.
All is vanity.
Yeah, all is vanity. The final conclusion is all is vanity. Yeah. You're going to answer the next one.
I got them mixed up last time.
what was the focus of the book? The context in which we read all of these scriptures?
Life
under the sun. here on earth. And what have we seen, I think, several times now? What is the author's recommendation how to live life on this earth?
Enjoy
what you have, eat and drink, be merry. it's not profitable, it's fleeting, it's futile, but it's what we got. We're just looking at life under the sun. And what was the outline of the book we covered in the first chapter? How do I present my outline, I should say?
Introduction, verse 1 through 3, chapter 1.
Yes. That's the second part. Somebody?
Futility and evil that's under the sun.
Sorry?
Futility and evil that's under the sun.
Yeah, futility and evil that's under the sun.
1 through 6, 12.
Yeah, chapter 1 through chapter 6. I call it observations, but that's basically what it is observing futility of life under the sun. And the next section. That would be chapter 7 and following.
Wisdom to apply in life.
Yeah, applicable wisdom. Those things which we can apply in this life. And that's chapter 7 through 12. In the very last few verses of chapter 12, we call it the conclusion or Solomon's final exhortation. So we move on to chapter 4. And we're still within the framework of observations of life under the sun. And in the first beginning of this chapter, verses 1 through 3, he goes into discussing the observations of oppression. In verse 1, "Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed. But they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun." And how do we define the oppression? I mean, what comes to mind when we think of oppression?
Injustice.
Yeah, injustice.
Bad treatment.
Bad treatment. Slavery. This is one of the things that comes to mind, the oppression of man. Well, and under slavery. When we look to the Merriam-Webster dictionary to define it, you see the definition is the unjust or cruel exercise of authority or power, or also, a sense of being weighed down in body or mind, which, I feel oppressed. Or, I guess it's more of an emotional feeling. It may not be someone who's physically oppressing you, but you feel that burden. And when we look to chapter 1, verse 1 of chapter 4, what type of oppression are we seeing here? I guess this, I put what oppressions are observed, and when I look back, I go, well, that's, maybe I didn't word that quite right. What I was looking at was what type of oppression are we seeing based on the definition?
I guess someone that has power over someone else.
Yeah, we see someone who has power over someone else. We see the unjust exercise of authority or power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what makes us see that in verse 1?
On the side of their oppressors was power.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. The people who are oppressing are the ones in power. We see that also mentioned in chapter 3, 16, we just covered, where it talks about, "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there." So in this case, you know, the judgment, the rulers, that's where the wickedness is, and iniquity. And also in verse 8 of chapter 5, we see the same observation made again. We see, "If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over a high official and higher officials are over them." We can get more into that when we get to chapter 5. Your translation may read a little differently than mine. But in each of these cases, we see in verse 1, the oppressors are the ones with power. In chapter 3:16, it's the rulers who are wicked. And, you know, in the other one, it's the high officials who are oppressing they're oppressing the poor and their violent perversion of justice. And we see here in verse 1 of chapter 4, the people, the oppressed, have no comforter. And why is that? These people don't have anyone to hold their hand and...
Well, God's not in the picture, so God's not there to comfort them.
Yeah, we're not talking about God as a comforter. But what about other friends and relations as a comforter? What do we think this means, that they have no comforter?
I guess sometimes when you're living under the sun, you know, there's people around you, but there's no comfort. Mm-hmm.
They're doing the same thing you're doing.
Yeah, that's possible. It could be they're all oppressed as well. I take it, you know, we see this as the those in power. I guess it's not because no one's willing to, you know, give them sympathy or befriend them or, you know, give them some support. It's a matter of, like we mentioned, God. The God isn't around to comfort. God has the power to stop things, if so willing. You know, we're talking about, I think here it's going into mention of a relief. How can someone be comforted if someone could relieve their oppression? And why do these people not get any relief from their oppression?
Michael, is verse 1 through 3 limited to rulers?
It's not limited to rulers, no.
You look around the job and you see an employer oppressing someone else. What are you going to do then? What can you do then? You live in families. You see husbands oppressing wives. You see parents oppressing children, treating them unjustly. You may know it, but what can you do then? And you know it goes on. It's just an observation about life. A lot of it that you don't even see. It's everywhere. Rich oppress poor. Take advantage of them at the court. There's no comfort. There's nothing you can do then. That's life. Pretty dismal picture, that's all there is. That's life.
Yeah. We certainly know that I guess I just always jump to rulers and authorities because they are people in power, and when they're in power, there's no one else that's going to relieve you of it, because, you know, like your boss, your employer, what are you going to do? Unless there's a bigger boss. But, yeah, exactly, Mr. Fondo's right, and we talk about, you know, any type of oppression. Colleagues can oppress one another and take advantage of one another. You can't stop everyone and make them act correctly. It happens. There's no stopping it.
Well, the other thing I understood, you've got the oppressed, and those who might comfort are also likewise oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
By the same power, whatever it is, same individual, false, whatever it is. So, you might think they might mutually comfort one another, but really that's not what happens. They've got somebody's exercising power over them in some fashion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly people can give each other sympathy, but I don't think that's what we're talking about here. It's just the comforting hand or the sympathy.
Relieve the oppression.
Yeah, we're talking about relief from that oppression, and there is no relief. It's just one of those inevitable things in life. So the preacher's conclusion in verse 2 and 3, he says, those are better off. And we've seen this before. Something is better than something else. It's not that there is a profit in it, but that being exactly that, just only that. This is better than that. And he says the dead are better over the living. And why is that? Why do we think that's the case?
It says here, because they've never seen that oppression and have to experience it.
Dead, yes. It's behind them.
Anymore. You're right. You're in verse 3, it starts to say that, you know, never seen it. But yeah, here, the dead, what do the dead care about oppression?
Right.
It's gone. It's no longer affecting them, right? The living, they still got to deal with it. You know, the dead, they've experienced it, but now, you know, it's over. They're free. It's no longer their concern. The dead, the living, we're still embroiled in life and all the things under the sun, and this oppression is one of them. And then he goes on to state, and then in verse 3, that there's someone who's better off than both the dead and the living. And who's better off than those?
The one that never had to experience it.
Yeah, the one who never had to experience or never seen it. Those are the people who never, well, you know, what do you call it? Hypothetically, those who have never been in existence, as if, you know,
just weren't born, I guess. That's what
the unborn, you could take it as the unborn, those who die in the womb or shortly after, infants, don't have to worry about it. It's just, I think it's just, you know, possibly just a hypothetical, you know. If you live, you have to deal with it. Once you die, it's over, but you still have to see it all. And, what does it say? Yeah, better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So they never have to see this. They never have to see the evil work. And when we talk about that scene, I guess, what does that mean to us? Is it just to physically lay eyes upon it, to witness it, or to experience it, or perhaps, you know, maybe to see the never seen as is maybe defined as that never understood it. You know, I think I was just listening to a song this morning that, you know, you can see that which is, but then there's a different scene with the mind, which is that which is the understanding. And so, what would we think this is, the witnessed or experienced?
Experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, does. I was going to say, suppose there is one person who didn't experience oppression. What if you are the king? Well, maybe, did he ever get oppressed? Just, you know, hypothetically, it's possible someone might get through life without being oppressed. Maybe he's the oppressor. Did he experience anything?
118 answers that question.
Chapter 118?
Yeah.
For in which much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Okay.
Michael, what do you think about the end of verse 1 in chapter 4? Is that a repetition of the people that are being oppressed, or is that saying the people that do the oppressing have no one to comfort? You know, you think about the economic situation right now. I heard a banker today saying how they got so terrible because everyone thinks they're awful people. And I was like, they can't comfort anybody because of what's happened. So maybe that oppression, maybe there's a sense of feeling that same pain as well. Maybe they're not in this bad situation, but the oppressor can't comfort. Is that a possible meaning that maybe comes out of that oppression?
I never thought of it. I just see it as the oppressors here have the power, and they're not giving any relief, any comfort. it doesn't, I don't think it just says whether it's within their power to give comfort or not. I just take it, if they're in power doing the oppressing, it's within their power to stop, but they don't. I don't see it as, you know, like, and, you know, in that case, a banker, I think, you know, maybe this analogy is taken out of place. You know, he's not oppressing people. People just perceive that bankers are bad right now, and that they're doing the oppressing. You know, a lot of bankers, and I'm going to get off top on that, you know, but, you know, they're just doing their job. So, I don't think so. But that doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot.
I don't know, I'm just
kidding. I'm sorry. I've seen it seem like there, you know, on the side of the oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. So, in a sense, I mean, even the oppressors feel something from which they don't have no comfort, as well as the people that are getting the people that they're oppressing. And they don't have no comforter either.
Verse 1, the tears are on the heart of the oppressed. The tears are on the part of the oppressed.
Yeah, here the people who need the comfort are the people who are being oppressed. That's how I read it. And I don't think the oppressors need any comfort. Unless you're saying they're trying to get comfort out of oppressing people and they don't get it.
I just thought there was some misery.
I think it's just a repetition for emphasis. But,
I think I kind of agree with Craig. Because if you read verse 2, about who are already dead more than living, who are still alive. He prays the dead because they're not oppressed. The powerful and the weak are oppressed, and they're the ones that eventually are dead. I mean, we're all going to be dead. Eventually, those are the only people that really have relief from oppression.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So if you look at the first part of verse 1, it says, look at the tears, the oppressed have tears. On the side of the oppressors is power. Neither has comfort or a comforter. And therefore, the only ones that really have relief, therefore I praise the dead who are already dead, because the powerful and the weak have no comfort.
I guess I'm missing something. Now, explaining why the oppressors need comfort.
I think maybe we're just getting lost in the pronouns that we see in the last part of the verse there. It says, on the side of the oppressors there is power. But they, and now you're changing the pronoun to mean the oppressors, have no comfort.
Mm-hmm.
Comfort. And like I said, I don't see that's the case.
Well,
I think it's a repetition of the they is still the oppressed from the beginning of the sentence.
Well, I guess Steve was talking about you know, parents having power over their child and maybe acting it as abusing them. I mean, I don't think the parents are going to be happy about that they're abusing their child. I think they would still feel something for them abusing their child. So I would think they would still want some sort of comfort.
I would think a normal parent.
Well,
there's a lot of non-normal people. There's a lot of non-normal people in the world.
I
think we're jumping outside what this verse means. I think here's the oppressed and they're distraught by oppression, and they don't have any comfort. And there's an oppressor, and he's the one with the power to do it. And because he has the power, no one can stop him. You know, there isn't someone else's, you know, like someone, you know, in our society is oppressing us, and it's not the government, then we go to the government for justice. Here, I read, it's the people who would administer justice here are the ones doing the oppression. Or, you know, or if you take it to mean, you know, not just mean, you know, like, I'm not saying specific to government, but in any case, it's the father in a family. The father in a family is the one with the authority and the power. If it's the boss at work, that's the one with the power and the authority within the work area.
I'm just repeating what Steve said. That's a good question, and I didn't hear an answer.
why do those with power need to have comfort?
Yeah.
I was going to try to answer that with the translators. They put in italics in the New American Standard the phrases, but they had no one to comfort. That's what my Bible says. I haven't looked this up on their translations. I was just wondering if they had it. They have no one to comfort.
Wait, what is yours? What is yours?
No, it doesn't add. It just says they had no one to comfort. Mm-hmm. I didn't say that they didn't have a comforter.
Them is in italics.
Mm-hmm. So the oppressors have nobody they can comfort. They can comfort those they oppress. See, I mean, logic doesn't follow.
It's just logic that doesn't follow.
There's no reason why the oppressor needs to be comforted.
But in today's society, I think a lot of people have sympathy.
I'm a murderer.
But people still don't want you to die.
I've decided to murder you. I need somebody to comfort me that I murdered you.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's why they have all those,
people
that say, oh, you don't deserve to die because you're still a human being.
That's not the president that has that. See, it's the other people who make it here where you're coming from. The oppressor doesn't. Why does the oppressor need comfort? That's the question he's asking. It's those who are oppressed that need comfort.
Mm-hmm. I might get some comfort if he stopped oppressing everybody. I see it pretty clearly as, you know, it's the tears, I mean, the oppressed are not getting the comfort. But that's why I just kind of thought we'd zoom right on through that. So, anyway, I guess, take it as you read it. but we were talking about those who are non-existent, and we were talking about witness versus experienced. And, whether we're saying, is this just these people who have never seen it? Is it the fact that they've never experienced it and that's why they're better off? Or is it that they've never witnessed it? And I was saying, certainly there might be some people in life who escape without experiencing oppression. But we've all witnessed it. Even if you're not experiencing it, you're going to witness it. And Mr. Fano went to, chapter 1:18, talking about, for in much wisdom is much grief, and increases knowledge increases sorrow. If you're on this earth, you're going to be learning, you're going to grow in some knowledge, and this is one of the things we learn, that it brings grief. as you're alive, you're going to learn, witnessing this oppression is going to bring some grief. Do you have a question, Jim?
Isn't that you're talking about experience, though? I mean, you gain wisdom from...
Well, it depends on your context of experience. I see experience as something you've personally, go through. And you might not personally go through any oppression. You may see the oppression, if you call that the experience. I guess what I'm defining as experience is it happens directly to yourself. You experience it in the first person. That's the only way I see you can experience it. The witnessing, not necessarily happening to you as the first person, but you witness something, that's how I define experience. So that's why I say it's the witnessing.
Okay, going back, is that knowledge, though? I mean, if you witness something, you see
something.
That's the knowledge you're gaining.
Right. That's what I'm saying. If you're alive on this earth, you're gaining the knowledge through the witnessing, and you may experience it, too.
But again, that brings grief.
Correct, it brings grief. The non-existent are better because they've never witnessed all this evil that's under the sun. All are going to witness it. And beginning in verse 4, he moves on to another observation. We read in verse 4 through 6. It says, "Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind." And he goes on and talks about the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. And we look first at this, this first verse, or first verse of this section, verse 4. He talks about observation of envy. The skilled workman is envied by his neighbor. When I look at skilled here, I see that as you know, when we see someone who's skillful, it's that they are doing something correctly. They're knowledgeable, so they do it correctly, they do it right. It's skillful and it's successful. If they're skilled at it, they're going to do it successfully. They're not going to try to build a door jamb with a 90 degree angle and come off with an unsquare door. With when you buy your 90 degree, you know, your square door and it don't fit in. Whoops, I didn't build that square. That's not successful. He didn't do it very skilled. So why does man envy? Here we see the neighbor envies the skilled worker. Why do we envy? Everyone knows why we envy. We all do it to some degree or greater. Jim?
Well, in this case, because he did the right thing. He's righteous. I mean, it wasn't...
Yeah.
So, is it, I mean, what somebody does, what they have, what they might, you know, possession or skill or exactly. Attribute or whatever.
Yeah, the envy is just something you don't have and right. Someone else has it.
Well, it's like
whatever that is.
And his father and the other brothers didn't feel like they had the attention of the father.
Yeah, it's indeterminate of just being something physical. It could be. Metaphysical, you know, it's anything that someone else has that you don't. You know, if it's possessions, riches, whether it's honor, whether it's acceptance or favor with others, love or family, you know, a lot of things we can't control who loves who, but still people get envious of it. And someone likes that person and not me, or is not accepted or doesn't receive favor. And when we look at 1 John, sorry. Yeah, it's all vanity because everything's short in this life. 1 John 3. I also wanted to ask, you know, where can envy lead? And we look at these scriptures. Just a few examples of envy through the rest of the scriptures. 1 John 3:12. We speak of it's Cain and Abel, and it talks here. Cain, who was the wicked one, and murdered his brother. And it says, why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. And when you go back to Genesis 4, 3, and 7, you see the instance of that. Well, we've already seen why he did it. His works were evil and Abel's were righteous. When you turn to chapter 4, actually I added this, Genesis chapter 4, beginning verse 3. So in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. And the Lord asked him, said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. And we see here, his offering was not accepted. He wanted to be accepted and he got angry over it. Well, you know, he needed to straighten up his act and do what was right, but he wanted to be accepted. We also, Griselda mentioned Joseph. We turn to Genesis 37. The story of Joseph and his brothers. And we see that in verse 5 through 11 of 37. It says, Joseph had a dream, he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And we know his dream was where the sheaves, all of his brothers' sheaves, bowed down to his sheaves. And then he had his other dream where the stars and the sun and moon bowed down to him, He told his father, even his father and mother were going to bow down to him. And it ends in verse 11, and his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in his mind. We know his brothers hated him before because of his father's attention to him. But this made them hate him even more and envied him even more. For not only do they have his father's attention, now they bring pride and honor into it. He's saying, you know, he's going to be ruling over them. They're going to be humble. And it's all just envy, desire for what they don't have that someone else does have. And when we read in Acts 7:9, it's just speaking of the same incident. In 7:9, this is in the patriarchs, the 12, the 11. Becoming envious, sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him. They envied him out of all that he had, but they didn't. I remember in 1 Samuel 18. Oh, yeah. First Samuel 18:8-9. There's Saul and David. And Saul was very angry. The saying displeased him, and he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" And verse 9 says, "So Saul eyed David from that day forward." And we know, in just shortly after that, in verse 11, I see that eye. He eyed him as a sign of his envy. And the outcome of that, the outburst of that envy, was in verse 11. Saul cast a spear, for he said, "I will pin David to the wall." But David escaped his presence twice. Here we see envy led Saul to attempt murder twice. So I asked before we jumped in here, where can envy lead? What have we seen in each of these cases?
Sin.
Yeah.
Sin spreads,
and
they rather just have one little thing
that
grows.
Yeah, envy led these people to great sin. We saw hate and attempted, we saw murder by Cain, attempted murder by Saul, and we know that Joseph's brothers were nearly murdering him and then just sold him into slavery, into Egypt. And we look at Proverbs 27. I like the way this... I like the way it's worded here. In Proverbs 27:4. "Wrath is cruel and anger a torrent, but who is able to stand before jealousy?" And to me, that brings to mind that we know wrath and cruelty and anger are terrible things to be in line of, but what can stand before jealousy? That's even worse. I mean, at least that's the way I read it. And it really brings to mind what envy can do to people. I guess, like Ms. Spano said, you get angry about something, and yeah, maybe your anger goes away. You might do something rashly, but maybe you get through it. Or in wrath. But it fades. But envy doesn't always fade. Because that which, wrath and anger may be aroused by a single act, but envy is by something that you don't possess. And so you continue on not possessing it, that envy can just, just continues and grows even, and eats at you.
I don't know how King James agrees on it, but you might understand it. I've seen it as a labor. Every skill which is done is rivalry between a man and his neighbor. It doesn't really say rivalry is envy. Doesn't really say who the envy is coming from.
Yeah.
A point, one way of looking at this is, as we've seen labor in other places, and we'll see following this, the whole idea of gaining things on this earth, even out of, in this case, rivalry or envy. Okay, you get it. So what? What's the product?
Yeah.
Same old vanity.
Yeah, same old vanity. There is no profit. And then I was just about to get to that mention. You said you had New American Standard. Well, that's fine. I was going to bring it up anyway. But the next question I have in the lesson was, what is the, well, we know that the skilled work, you know, he's laboring. What was the motivation of this labor? And I realized I have New King James, so mine reads as, you know, the skilled labor is kind of, skilled workman is doing his thing, and then the neighbor is the envious. So the envy is in the neighbor, like, as if it's his fault. Yeah, but American Standard reads differently. That, if I had it written down. Well, I didn't write it down, because it would have said, but it attributes the envy to the person doing the work, as if he's trying to stir up envy in his neighbor. And I know that is the case in some instances. So it depends which version you have. But, you know, this one thing is a fact. Whether the guy is just doing his work and this guy's envious, or if he's trying to stir up envy. Stir up envy would be a very, very dangerous game to play. Just because we just read what the outcome, the end result can be. You know, if he's trying to stir up envy, man, he's just poking the beehive. he's gonna get stung with that one, playing with fire. Because, you know, any number of horrible things, you know, he could provoke his neighbor to do. And but if he doesn't, you know, even if it isn't him stirring up the envy, Mr. Hollisbecker said the outcome really is the same, whether he's causing envy or on purpose or not. Or what were they doing? I was going to say, even if he's not trying to cause it, envy just happens. I mean, because why are people envious, like we said? Because they don't have something. So, I'm losing my thoughts here. Oh, okay. I got it back. The skilled labor, I read it as just skilled labor, guy doing his job. Some people read that skilled labor as excessive labor. By excessively, you know, doing more, he's gaining more, possessing more, and that causes envy. I don't really think that's really matters here, because as I stated, envy is just someone who has less than someone else. So it doesn't take someone to work excessively to get more than someone else. If you're just a moderate worker, if you have more than someone else, they're going to envy you. You're not trying to envy, you're just doing your, you know, you're providing for your family. He's not providing for his, he might still envy you. So, you know, it doesn't, the outcome is the same. Envy leads to sin. It's very, very dangerous, and it's all futility anyway. You know, to gaining possessions or whatnot. It's all our lives all end. So it's the same outcome regardless. Yep, and I had that point in there. All vanity, all is vanity regardless.
What you say is true, but I don't know that anything in the text about him trying to stir up envy in his neighbor. I don't see that in the text.
Well, it depends which translation you have.
Well, I've got the New American Standard. It doesn't say about stirring up envy. Yes. It says the result of rivalry between him and his neighbor. You got a bigger deck than mine. I'm going to build a bigger one. Yeah. Well, I said, they got a nicer house than mine. I'm going to go take two more jobs. Always what the other guy got, I want to top.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, like what we said, now we both die. What happens?
Yep. It's over.
So your whole life is built, motivated by looking over the fence. Only to end up in the grave. You lose your family, you lose your health, you lose your spirituality. So that's not his point here, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
That's another way to do it. Interesting, right? I don't know that there's a subtle difference between rivalry and envy, but I don't know what it is. And I look out the film and say on that basis, but I just think about the work you're in, the work I was in with Exxon. I mean, any company, there is a competition that always goes on. Now, you know, we think of envy as evil, I guess, the evil side of it. We don't think of getting promotion as envy. But in this context, I think that's exactly what it is. It's the idea of I'm in a competition with my neighbor, who happens to be the guy I'm working with, and I'm going to get to be the boss someday over him, by the way. So, you know, it fits in that, to me, it fits in that very context. And yet, when it's all said and done, for both of us, it's the same outcome.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think envy is the matter of the attitude of the person. I mean, I don't know.
Well, being noble is we work for a living, we work for our boss, and we're not working because we're trying to beat the other guy. But in fact, that's what a lot of industry is, trying to beat the other guy. On an individual basis, yeah, you're working for the boss, but you're trying to do a better job than the guy next to you.
Yeah. I don't know. I wouldn't say competition is envy. You know, we have to compete to, you know, to get by. But I think, yeah, I think it's a matter of attitude. I think you could compete without being envious. But certainly, yeah, plenty of people compete solely out of envy. Anyway, the end results are the same. It's not going to get you anywhere, even if you beat the other guy. You still lose. You both lose.
You know, I think sometimes, like what Wally said, you know, sometimes there's a difference. Some people actually seek the joy of accomplishment, while others are seeking the admiration of your coworkers or of the boss. They're more concerned with admiration for men than they are
self-accomplishment.
Yes, and. I can see, you know, where if you're seeking the admiration of men, you are more envious. Whereas someone that's seeking to accomplish something would be less envious.
Yeah.
And, you know, bottom line, basically, you're never going to be happy. This kind of person is never going to be happy, whether they're seeking for the praises of men, whether they're seeking for money. There's no contentment. It's futile. Because you're never going to, you know, get there. The envious is something else. I mean, it's
too much more, right?
Exactly.
The danger, Michael. Well, everything you said about envy is true. But like Wally pointed out, leave the word envy out. Let's suppose it's a noble thing. You just want to be better.
Yeah.
You build a better. You've got a better oil company. I'm going to build a better oil company. What's wrong with that?
That's just
an observation. That is the way we work.
Yeah.
But when you view life under the sun, that's what your whole life is about. What a waste. And you're saying that it's all gone. And the reason I say it's important is because we have a tendency to excuse ourselves. So I'm not envious. I work hard.
Yeah.
I'm going to accomplish things. I'm not envious. So this don't apply to me.
Yeah. I know what you're saying. We're applying the connotation of sin and evil to this envy, but when we remove that connotation of evil, just even if it is just true competition without, you know, sinful nature, darker side, but yeah, where does it still get you? It doesn't get you anywhere. It's all, as the verse says, grasping for the wind. And it's something you're never going to catch.